Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Okay, Buzzkillers, here we are. It's me, it's Professor Buzzkill, and fortunately for you, we're talking about a fantastic subject that I really nerded out on when I received this book, because I remember in the 1970s as a young teenager being very interested in the conservation movement and the hiking movement, which seemed to be exploding at that stage. But of course, there was a lot more history and background to it. Fortunately for you, we have on the line, via the internets, Philip Denary, who's written a new book on the Appalachian Trail. Hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, as I say, I totally nerded out on this book because I remember the AT being a big thing for me and a number of my friends when I was in middle school and high school and just starting our backpacking and things like that. But one of the things that's so interesting about your book is you called it The Appalachian Trail, a Biography. And I like the idea of a biography of a natural phenomenon and something that's out in nature and constructed. It's sort of a person, and you've made it that way in the book.
Well, that's what I aimed to do. I mean, the trail is a construction. It's thing, and I don't mean that in the humanities social construction way. No, it is a physically constructed thing, and it's got a history. It's a product of its times, just like a person would be. And mm-hmm. So my aim was to tell its story in its historical context. And I think we can see it differently in the present tense when we see where it came from historically.
Well, let's start at the beginning. I mean, can't beat that. Where did it come from? It seems to be, first of all, it's massive. For our non-American listeners, we should tell them that it runs, I don't know, all the way from Maine to Georgia. And it's probably the longest hiking trail, maybe the second longest next to the Pacific Coast one in the world. But how does it start? Is it something that comes out of the New Deal? Is it a Civilian Conservation Corps thing? Is it something before that? Are they old hunting trails? What is the sort of way back of the way back story of the Appalachian Trail?
There is some New Deal and some Civilian Conservation Corps, but it goes earlier than that. But it doesn't go back to pre-existing trails for other purposes. So okay. As with most inventions, there's both the, you know, here's the person that invented it version, and then here's the scene that it came out of version.
Right.
The person who invented it version is, in November of 1921, a planner and social thinker and agitator named Benton McKay published an article titled An Appalachian Trail, A Project in Regional Planning. Mm-hmm. That was the start of it. It was an idea in his head, and he put it out there, and that crystallized a whole bunch of people's activity, and that kicked it off, and the first version of the trail was completed roughly 15 years later. But it grew out of a growing hiking scene, especially in the northeastern U.S., that had been developing for decades at that point. And people interested in the outdoors would get together in clubs. They would blaze and then open up these trails. And eventually they said, hey, maybe we could connect one trail to the other and create a network of trails. So McKay saw this happening, and he had some other things that he was after as well. And he kind of cooked it all together into this big, bold proposal. But he was the first to admit that the idea of big long distance trails and networks of them that cover a long distance didn't come out of his head alone.
Why did they come up with the idea that people would be interested in such long trails? I mean, was it a belief that people will want to hike the whole trail, or is it we might as well have these connecting trails all the way so people can do little bits at different times? I mean, was there a rising tide of public opinion saying we desperately want to hike from Maine to Georgia?
Definitely not. All of the early activists that made the AT what it is had no notion that it would be ever used for through hiking. And considered that a stunt that they really wanted nothing to do with. The idea of creating such a long trail was that if the trail was continuous from Maine to Georgia, then no matter where you were on the eastern seaboard, you would be within a day's travel so that you would have access to it. Mm-hmm. So the length of it was not about completing it from one end to the other. In fact, they talked about it as though it was a practically endless trail. You know, turning it into something with ends that have to be completed is a fairly recent invention in the way that we think about the trail. To them, the value of it was whether you're in New York or Philadelphia or Atlanta or Washington or Boston, you're not going to be far away from a hiking opportunity that you can take advantage of for as long as you want to. Could be a day hike, could be a few nights, and that's the way they thought about it.
Oh, so the length of it is really the accessibility of it. That's the main thing. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, how difficult was it to get this sort of approved and to get it going? I mean, the organization of it seems just enormous.
Yeah, the organization was enormous, and Mackay, who invented it, did not have the patience for the organization. Mm-hmm. Moreover, he was interested in the trail as the backbone of big protected zones of natural territory with small recreational settlements in them. To him, the trail was the backbone for a bigger project in what he called regional planning. And he was more interested in developing his ideas around regions, the relationship between city and nature, between the social economy of the world and the natural economy of the world. He was a big thinker. So he spent those early years getting action going on the trail a little bit and doing some of this organizing, but also trying to write books and get this larger project underway. He was relatively quickly succeeded by a man named Myron Avery, who was a Washington, D.C. lawyer, who basically said, yeah, the heck with all the philosophy. I want to get a trail built, and I want to get it built right away. So Avery was the one who, with just incredible drive and energy, and I think what today we would call compulsion, organized volunteers from up and down the trail to go out there and blaze the trail and clear it and get the thing built. So what he cared about was the construction of the trail from one end to the other. He did most of the blazing himself. He led these expeditions to mark where it would go. The getting it built wasn't that hard because, I mean, there was a ton of work and organizing and volunteer labor and sweat and blood and tears and all of that, but these weren't, for the most part, very settled territories. Oh. There were big expanses of open timber forests that might be, owned by a single timber company. And, you reach an informal agreement with the timber company, can we run our trail through your forest? And they say, okay, fine. So in the later years of the trail, that wasn't true. And that necessitated the latter part of the story, which was the National Park Service getting involved. But in the 1920s and 30s, there were big open spaces, big, for the most part, unsettled spaces that they could run the trail through. I have to contradict myself, though. When I say unsettled, I should say sparsely settled.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So the mountains were full of Appalachian people living lives up in these hollers, in the backwoods, folks that didn't register on the radar screens of those who wanted to imagine a pristine nature they could hike in. But nevertheless, it was sparsely settled enough that they could put the trail through without too much difficulty.
But they didn't have to deal with coal mine companies. They didn't have to deal with necessarily, obstinate state governments, because it is a kind of isolated trail. It is high in the mountain. It's not, it's not a place where you are disrupting coal mining by putting something like that there or anything like that.
Yeah, by and large, they were able to work out a series of agreements with various landholders. By the way, the biggest then and to this day were the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service, and then state lands as well. But they could run the trail over private property back then, and it more or less worked. Then as that private property got developed for vacation homes and ski resorts and, you know, radio and TV towers in the second half of the 20th century, then really all of it needed to be brought under public protection. But from the get-go, the national forests and the national parks provided the biggest stretches of AT and still do.
Okay, so that's the 1920s. Now, as we move into the 1930s, is there a way, are there ways in which the Civilian Conservation Corps and other organizations get involved and help build it, help make it more, quote, national, unquote?
Yeah, in particular, the farther you got from the cities that could be home to volunteers that would want to work on this, the more you needed to find other people to do the work. So the Civilian Conservation Corps, in the creation of Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee and North Carolina, did a lot of work on the trail and in some of the other southern locations. And then especially in Maine, the portion of the AT in Maine is nowhere near the coast. It is in western, deeply forested Maine. Mm-hmm. And while there was volunteer labor there as well, Avery used his connections in the federal government to get Civilian Conservation Corps crews to do the work there. So the last original segment of the AT was cleared between a couple of mountaintops in Maine in 1937 by a CCC crew.
Well, since we're still on that early period, and before we get to the question of ski resorts and power lines and all that sort of stuff, may we talk a little bit about the as you say, the people who live in the area of the trail, the people who, it was sparsely settled, but there were people there. Was there any sort of opposition to a trail, or was it seen as a good thing? I can't imagine that very many people were dispossessed of their lands, but I would wonder how much of their concerns were taken into account when it was being constructed, conceived and constructed.
People were dispossessed of their lands in the creation of the national parks that the AT runs through.
Right, okay.
So the two big southern national parks, Great Smoky Mountains and Shenandoah National Park, Great Smoky Mountains, as I said, in Tennessee and North Carolina, Shenandoah in Virginia, there were people living in these backwoods communities that were kicked out via the process of eminent domain. The federal government seized the property, said, we're going to turn this into a park, and there's no room for you here anymore. And oh, by the way, bisecting the park, and one of its great features will be this Appalachian Trail that runs over the ridgeline right down the center of the place. And that's true for both of those national parks. So there is no invention of nature. There's no creation of natural spaces without willful and sometimes even not all that subtle eradicating of the human history that was already there. A native history that predated European settlers, then European settlers, so-called mountain people, as they were called at the time. You know, folks that, so the reality of the lived lives of these places don't necessarily fit with the pristine nature that the urbanites want to imagine an escape to. And so in the creation of these places, yeah, folks lose their land. And then there's a more modern version of that when the federal government wanted to create a corridor for the trail because it was falling apart due to private development. Again, people had their lands taken for the trail.
Is there any opposition to this initially? Is it any organized opposition? It's often difficult to get organized opposition in these remote areas, but...
Definitely. I don't know much about how organized the opposition was to those national parks that created a home for the trail. Absolutely, in the 1970s and 80s, very strong organized protests, communities getting very agitated about the AT coming through. In the long run, it's proved to be a rather productive partnership, and those tensions aren't there to nearly the same extent they once were. But definitely, the... not everybody in the creation of the AT loved its creation and the way that it happened. And when I say the creation of the AT, you have to remember it's been rebuilt, rerouted, reinvented multiple times over its history. In the very early history, there wasn't much of that pushback. But the more that 20th century America didn't really leave room for a woodsy AT, the more it had to be carved out of this, you know, larger development scene. And that's where the controversy came.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. I mean, it seems like it'd be too easy to say there's a pre-World War II AT and a post-World War II AT because you're talking about the 70s and the 80s. But why is it in the 70s that there is this sort of second wave of building and rooting and planning and all that stuff?
A couple of reasons. One is that it really got to a make or break point. So enough of this vacation home development, ski resort development, et cetera, was encroaching on where the trail had been, and therefore pushing the trail onto road shoulders. Oh, you know, our trail used to go over this mountain. It can't do that anymore because the timber company sold it to somebody who subdivided it and built a bunch of vacation properties there. Okay, so instead of going over the mountain, it'll go along the highway around that mountain, and then it'll pick up, you know, with where the trail used to be. So this fraying of the trail and this, you know, taking it out of the woods and onto roads had been going on in a piecemeal way really ever since the end of World War II. And it got to the point where there just wasn't going to be an AT anymore. The other thing is, in the 60s, the environmental movement emerges in America, the modern environmental movement. And it has dear place in its heart for natural places, places that provide an alternative to sprawling suburbia and the cities and all of that. So the AT really needed help, and this burgeoning environmental movement was looking for projects to champion, and those two things came together in some federal legislation in the 1960s.
And that legislation sort of insisted that the trail be not only rerouted where it needed to be rerouted, but need to be sort of strengthened and made more, and I'm putting this in quotation marks here, permanent.
Yeah. And the first version of the legislation in the 1960s started this effort. It wasn't that effective, and they took another go at it in the Carter administration in the late 1970s, and that's when they really got it right. But what they said was, we are going to build an AT from Maine to Georgia, where it's not currently within the protection of the National Park Service or the U.S. Forest Service or a state government somewhere. Then we, the federal government, are either going to buy the land, the best land for the best version of the trail, or we're going to go negotiate what are called conservation easements, where they don't own the land, but they own the right to run the trail over it. And the federal government became, you know, deeply committed to this in the 1970s, and it took a couple of decades of land acquisition, you know, year after year, piece after piece. But now the entire trail corridor, virtually the entire trail corridor, is either contained within a state park, a national forest, or in a special purpose National Park Service corridor that gives it permanent protection.
Okay, so when I mentioned that in the 70s, I became interested in this because, you know, it was a kind of a nifty thing when I was a teenager, there was also a lot of it was a national issue. May not have been the most important national issue at the time, but it certainly wasn't an unknown thing. The trail was also kind of new or renewed in that period.
Yeah, doesn't it so often happen that those things that we find ourselves getting into and they're a big part of our personal story, and then we look back and realize, oh man, I was just a part of this huge fad. Everybody else was doing the same thing. Yeah, it's definitely the case that 70s environmentalism, this 60s, 70s environmentalism, it picked up on this back to nature movement or style of thinking that really had much earlier roots in American thought. And the early part of the book is mm-hmm. about that. But everybody was saying, you know, the world just doesn't make sense. It's big, it's scary, it's overwhelming. I want to get in touch with some sort of more enduring reality. I want to go off to the woods. I want to spend time there. And the idea of a trail that, on the one hand, is right in the backyard of these big metropolitan areas, but on the other hand, it's this tunnel of naturalness that just goes and goes and goes, that proved really attractive to a lot of people. And so, yeah, use of the trail skyrocketed in the 70s.
And was it an inspiration for building other trails, such as the Pacific Coast Trail and other things? I mean, we seem to be bracketed in the United States by these two big trails. And in fact, there are clubs of people, and it's a sort of a badge of honor to be able to have thru-hiked both of the trails. You know, there are Facebook groups totally dedicated to this, people who've done both. The Pacific Coast Trail, the Colorado one, the Rocky Mountain Trail, and the Appalachian Trail seem to be the triple crown of long-distance hiking.
Yes, there is the so-called triple crown, and it is a passionate community, which I, by the way, am a complete outsider to. I'm interested in the AT as a place, but I'm not a big hiker, and I'm to a certain extent encroaching on their territory by writing this book. The Pacific Crest Trail did have its own history among West Coast enthusiasts independent of the AT, but this legislation in the 1960s that federalized the Appalachian Trail at the same time created what's called the National Trails System. And the National Trails System, when they first passed the bill in the late 60s, included just two, the AT and the PCT. But it laid the groundwork for the development of others, the Continental Divide Trail. There are now several, I want to say the number is 14, official trails in the National Trails System overseen by the National Park Service. They don't all have that same level of Park Service ownership of the corridor. A lot of them are cobbled together in the way the AT used to be between, you know, a state park here and a highway shoulder there. But nevertheless, it is now a National Trail System, which interestingly was part of Benton McKay's original vision back in the 1920s. His idea was, we're not just building a hiking venue, we're building a system of natural protection that will define the American landscape in both a physical way, but also in a social and economic way, he hoped. The totality of that vision never, you know, fully came to pass, but he has been vindicated to some extent.
Sure, but if there are that many, I only think of the big three. If there are 14 of them of varying levels of sophistication, that's an amazing thing. One of the most interesting things about the book to me was how, you know, roughly halfway through, you start to realize that through hiking, the idea of going from one end of the trail completely to the other end of the trail in one go is kind of a new thing. It says, as you say, it wasn't one of Benton McKay's early ideas, but it became this thing in the second half of the trail's history.
You know, from the start, people did think about that. And one of the predecessors of the AT was Vermont's Long Trail, which runs the length of the state of Vermont from bottom to top. And for the bottom half of it, it is also the route for the Appalachian Trail.
Right.
And from the minute the Long Trail was completed, again, this same phenomenon of, look, we built it so that there's hiking close to each of these towns, and we're imagining that people will go for short hikes on it. But to the surprise of the founders, people said, well, hey, I might try to hike the whole thing. I might even try to see if I can be the fastest to do it, which is something that people now do on the AT. So it is a fairly recent phenomenon. Definitely this notion that when people hear the AT, they think about a through hike almost exclusively. If you use the phrase hiking the Appalachian Trail, there's this immediate inference that that's hiking all 2,100 miles of it in one summer-long excursion. And yeah, that is a recent development. It's still the case that around 1% of, these are the Appalachian Trail Conservancy's numbers, about 1% of AT users are through hikers. So the vast majority of people who are out there are, you know, taking shorter day trips, or maybe they're out for two or three nights or something like that. But the part of it that's captured our late 20th, early 21st century imaginations is the AT as a place of personal trial and personal accomplishment. And definitely in the era of social media, it becomes, you know, a provider of social media authenticity, all of which are new things that both the early creators of the AT in the 1920s and the protectors of it in the 1960s and 70s never really anticipated or had as a high priority for themselves.
Well, who were the first people to sort of maybe not do the hike all the way through, but to sort of publicize the idea of the complete hike, the through hike, and as an achievement, a Mount Everest of American hiking, for instance?
Yeah, that definitely is one individual person. Okay. And I'm realizing that too is a redundancy. I should have said one individual. Anyways, his name was Earl Schaefer.
Right.
And Earl Schaefer came home from World War II disgusted with the world and having a hard time figuring out what he was going to do next. And he knew that the AT was out there and that nobody had ever hiked it from one end to the other. And he set out to do that in 1948 and did so. And he thought of it as an accomplishment that would be shared with others. He took pictures as he went. He kept a log as he went. He planned to write a book about it. So the invention of the AT as something to be thru-hiked and the thru-hike as an achievement to be shared is really Earl Schaefer's. But again, other people, as they heard about it, including a 66-year-old grandmother in Ohio, said, oh, I think I might like to walk that whole thing. And Emma Grandma Gatewood, a couple of years after Earl Schaefer, went out and did the same thing herself because she just liked walking in the woods and she thought this would be a neat thing to do. So lots of different people came to it for different reasons. They didn't all, you know, seek publicity for it or, you know, necessarily label it as a life achievement. But the beginning of the thru hike as thru hike is clearly Earl Schaefer in the late 1940s.
Wow, that was amazing in the book. I didn't realize that it would have been that early because in order now there thru hikers are able to get a lot of support on the way. There are a lot of, you know, organizations that tell you how to do it, the best places to stop, places to supply, resupply and all that stuff. But in 1940, there was not, in 1948, there was none of that.
Yeah. I mean, Schaefer figured it out for himself and then became corresponding secretary for the Appalachian Trail Conference, as it was then called. So as other people were interested in doing bigger expeditions, they would write into the ATC, they would send the letters to Earl Schaefer, and he would reply. So he figured out a lot of this stuff and, you know, and shared it with others. But a lot of people were doing it. So Schaefer did it for the first time in 1948. There would be a couple of people for years, a couple of people per year for decades after that, you know, it was a personal accomplishment for them. I'm sure their friends and family knew about it. They shared it with the ATC, and it was sort of a novelty within the AT community. But it's not until the 70s, really, that it becomes a much more popular thing, and people are undertaking this at the level of hundreds or even now thousands per year. When Schaefer reported his hike to the ATC, they said, huh, really? And they did a little bit of vetting of his story to see if it was actually true. They grilled him, well, you know, tell us about this part of the trail, tell us about that part of the trail. And he passed that. And they took note of it in their publication, but it's not like there was this big banner headline in the AT newsletter, oh my gosh, the first person has thru-hiked. It was really seen as a curiosity.
That's amazing. Well, I think a lot of our listeners will first have come across the idea of thru-hiking, if not first have come across the idea of the trail at all, through the famous book by Bill Bryson, A Walk in the Woods, which is a fantastic, fantastic book. How did that sort of come about? Why did Bryson decide, oh, well, I'll do that? I mean, he was already a famous travel writer. Was there then a burning desire to do the trail?
He was a famous writer, but he had not really cracked the U.S. market when he wrote that book. He was huge in Britain, remains to this day a national treasure in Britain. He had written a book about an American road trip, and that was actually the first book that really made his name, and it was not well received in the U.S. So he writes a few more books about Europe, about Britain itself, becomes this big, you know, rock star writer in the UK. He's selling books in the US, but not a ton. His family wanted to live in the US. They moved to the college town of Hanover, New Hampshire, where the AT runs right down Main Street.
And by the way, we should tell people that who don't know that Bill Bryson is an American who went over to Britain in the 70s and fell in love with his wife and married and stayed there. But sorry, go ahead.
That's fine. Born and raised in Iowa, made his professional career as a journalist while living in Britain because he had met his wife there. And then the whole family moved back here for a short while. So he was fishing around for his next topic and he needed an American journey for his next book, but he'd already done the road trip. Well, what else could be a classic American journey? It's a sign of how much the AT had become a part of the general American culture at that point that, now, yes, he happened to live next to it, but it's a sign of what the AT had become, that the thru hike came onto his radar screen as, oh, I'll do a book about that, and that'll be, you know, my blockbuster with the American audience. And that's exactly what it was. He is an immensely skilled and observant writer, and he took off on this trip. He didn't wind up through hiking, but his failure to through hike became as much a part of the book as, you know,
That's completing one would have been.
And as he, you know, not surprisingly anticipated being the successful author that he is, you know, the book sold a gajillion copies.
Well, not only is he an observant and good writer, so are you, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about the Appalachian Trail in a dry, dusty, you know, this is a government infrastructure project and all sorts of things over the years. And historians like me get excited about it because, you know, it's, you show the complications of everything that happened, but you really make it come alive through all these the people and personalities who were involved in its founding, involved in its development. And we can't recommend the book highly enough. Of course, it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf for the blog post for this episode. So we encourage our listeners to go get it. And I just want to say thank you for writing it, first of all. And thank you to Houghton Mifflin for telling me about it so you could come on the show and say, well, how can you convince people? How can you help people understand why, even if it's just an afternoon's hike on the trail, it's worth it?
When you hike on the AT, wherever you are, you feel like you're a part of something bigger. You are. The trail at any particular point can be a pretty mundane thing. You're walking on a trail in the woods, and it doesn't necessarily feel in the walking like it's anything special. But the length of it, the history behind it, it's this central piece of kind of American physical culture, if you will. And it feels pretty cool to have even one little piece of it, you know, for a short hike. And by the way, because it covers the high ground, wherever it can find it, from Georgia to Maine, there's a pretty good chance that it's going to be a pretty, you know, scenic and interesting hike as well.
Yes. Well, the parts I've been on in Pennsylvania and in upstate New York are very beautiful. They're idyllic, and they're, you know, sylvan, as we say in Pennsylvania, very leafy. And it is, as Bill Bryson says, a walk in the woods. But as you've shown, it's so much more than that. And it's such an important part of our history that more people need to know about it. So it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It was a very enjoyable conversation.
And we'd like all the Buzzkillers to go to the blog post to get the book, obviously. And we'll say to all of them that we will talk to you next week.